This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, President Bush talks to workers in North Carolina about the economy improving. Also, could a case be made for President George W. Bush being the worst in history? And can those of us who've never done the job make that call? Joining us to find out what's behind the news are, from our New York bureau, Marcelo Suarez Orozco. Economist and author Julianne Malvo is at member station WFDD in Greensboro, North Carolina. And we've got George Curry, editor-in-chief of the National Newspaper Publishers Association News Service in Laurel, Maryland. Thank you all for joining me. And let's go to the economy first. So just a few weeks ago, President Bush was speaking out against critics of the war and called for patience from the American people. Now the president has turned his attention to another concern: the economy. He went into a North Carolina factory on Monday, spoke to workers about how the nation is on the right track. Here's a little bit of what he said.
In the past 5 years, our economy has endured a stock market collapse, a recession, terrorist attacks, corporate scandals, high energy costs, and devastating natural disasters. These were all shocks to our economy, which I felt required decisive action. I believe that economy grows when people are allowed to keep more of their own money, to be able to save and to spend. And so I called on the United States Congress to let the people keep more of their own money, to cut their taxes, and Congress responded.
So in addition to tax cuts, there have been 10 quarters of steady economic growth, 215,000 jobs created in November alone. But public opinion polls show that people are not happy. In fact, 63% of Americans rated the economy bad, very bad, or terrible. Is President Bush getting a raw deal here, Marcelo?
There has been a very uneven distribution in terms of the economic growth. There is a growing, an increasing pattern of inequality. This has been a massive transfer of wealth to the upper fifth percentile of the income distribution. And the average American worker has, in fact, lost ground in terms of hourly wages over the last 5 years. So it's going to be a difficult case to make to suggest that the average worker in the U.S. today is, if we ask the eternal question Ronald Reagan once asked, are you better off today than you were 4 years ago? The answer for most American workers today is no, we're not better off today.
Julianne, can you expand on that, especially because America is a consumer economy? How much we spend really has a lot of influence on how well the economy is doing. Are people going to keep spending money when they feel so uneasy?
Well, unfortunately, people are spending money and a bit more than they should be. But the term I use for RIDE to describe our situation is macroeconomic ecstasy and microeconomic angst. If you look at the indicators, 4.3% growth, 215,000 jobs created, which incidentally is not enough jobs to sustain a recovery. We need to be generating 300,000 jobs a month plus, and we aren't. We've got all these layoff headlines. But you look at the indicators in general, and they look okay. The day after Thanksgiving was a positive day. But then you look, as Marcelo has just said, at the individual and how people are faring. The people who are doing well are the people at the top. If you're a stockholder, if you're a homeowner, you are basically doing very well. And not all homeowners, but especially stockholders. Corporate profits are way up, but wages are stagnant. Why do Americans continue to spend? Because we live in a spending culture. But I think that when the dust clears after this holiday season, which incidentally retailers are counting on in some sectors for 40%, you know, of their spending, of their sales rather, in jewelry, almost half of all jewelry is sold during this period. I think when the dust clears, it's not going to look as good as we think it will. This economy is not booming. It's booming for a few people, and by and large, it's failing. There are a whole bunch of words the president didn't use when he talked about all the things that have happened in the economy, and he's avoided his own complicity in the corporate scandals, in the high in energy costs, and in the so-called tax cuts that leave us with a crippling deficit.
George, let me bring you in on a slightly different tack. What about reporting on the economy? When the average person reads about 215,000 jobs created in November and somebody like Dr. Malvo says, well, that's not enough, how are we supposed to know that? How can the media do a better job of helping people sort through these economic issues?
Well, you have to say all of you. You have to say that there's been a job increase of 215,000. There's been 10 quarters of steady economic growth. You need to say that. But you also got to say that even the person who was a member of Reagan's Council of Economic Advisors said the misery index, the combination of unemployment and inflation, has gotten worse. In fact, it was at a 12-year high in September. So it's above what it's been the last two decades. It's above what it was when Bush came to office. So you have to say the message is mixed. And I agree with her that, you know, certainly these gains are certainly tilted toward the people who are most affluent, but you got to say it's mixed at best.
Let me just ask about another specific issue, pensions. It seems that every week brings new news that some company is changing its pension benefits or eliminating it. It seems patently unfair to bring people into a work environment, promise them a certain amount of retirement money, and then say, uh-oh, we don't have any money, so you don't either. Julianne, how is that playing into the instability?
Well, I think, first of all, it's playing into the malaise. You have people who, as you say, counted on getting a certain number of dollars per month, and now they're being told that they're going to be tested on their acumen as an investor. That's exactly why lots of people avoid the stock market. They don't want the risks in their companies. And these are really smokestack foundational companies in our country are saying, oh, well, forget about it. Verizon, the most recent, and Verizon is posting profits. It's absurd to have this kind of a switch, but what it really does is leaves working people, people who do not follow the stock market every day, far more vulnerable. In the airline industry, we've seen, you know, tens of thousands of people find their pensions really cut by a third by changes.
And George, again, around the issue of reporting on this, when you look at the picture of how people feel, has your association, the National Newspaper Publishers Association News Service, really been going out and trying to tap into the black community's sense of how the economy is treating black folks? And what are you finding out?
Certainly we have that, and we have a lot of stories of people who have an almost six figures income and suddenly they're waiting tables. I mean, that is a reality, and unemployment is always at least 2 to 3 times higher among African Americans, and that has not changed under George Bush, so those pains are real.
Marcelo, I want to direct you to another topic. We're looking at the visit of Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice to Europe. She landed in Berlin, ended up getting a bit upbraided by a German official who told a joint news conference with Rice that the United States had acknowledged that it essentially kidnapped the wrong person, Khaled El-Masri, a German national who's also Muslim, who spent, he alleges, 5 months in detainment for being a member of a terrorist cell when he was in fact nothing of the sort. The Washington Post has been following this story, found a lot of evidence that his story is true. Now, one, how bad is this for the administration?
The policy of rendition, the shuttling of prisoners to secret prison sites in Europe, is further eroding U.S. legitimacy and really its ability to command the higher ground in pursuing what is now an open-ended, ongoing war on terror. Just returned from a series of lectures in Rome, in Antwerp, in Brussels, and you can feel in the air the ethos of distrust and hostility to this administration precisely around these issues of the role of Europe in the shuttling of and possibly torture of prisoners in European settings.
But let me just frame another part of this, which is that Germany apparently allowed its airspace to be used for these renditions. Should Germany and other European countries who are allowing the U.S. to use their airspace, to use their resources, also be brought to task?
Of course they should be brought to task. The use of airspace is an independent issue from the rendition of prisoners through secret detention camps.
And Julianne, Marcelo, who is the co-director of immigration studies at New York University, was talking about going overseas, feeling as if there is a pall over the respect for the U.S. government. Is that going to affect our ability to operate economically, socially in the world?
Absolutely. I think that some of the respect that we had commandeered in the past, in addition to the fact that we were a 700-pound gorilla, in addition to the fact that we supposedly stood for democracy, all led to some kowtowing to America, or at least some deference. The deference is gone. China takes us on. Germany takes us on. Tiny little countries take us on. It's changed the tone and tenor of relations at the United Nations. But literally, we have squandered our moral authority not only on this war in Iraq, but also on these practices. Abu Ghraib, it would be an example. This rendition policy would be another. And I think that Secretary Rice is way off base by attempting to create some equivalency. Using your airspace is not the same as torturing people.
There's just I think it's no very interesting in her language, George. Too. I think it's very interesting in her language. She's very careful, and you really have to pay attention to her. She said the United States is not doing this. We're not taking people to these other countries and secret camps, but does not say the United States has not instructed other countries to do that, that they're doing it in a more subtle way. I mean, you got to watch the language, because when you get beyond the language, the reality is still there.
Well, George, let's look at Condoleezza Rice as a black woman. A lot of times during other tense moments in U.S. history, black folks could go abroad, for example, and people would say, oh, yeah, you've been mistreated by your government. Come here, brother. Now you've got Condoleezza Rice and before that Colin Powell representing the face of American foreign policy. Has that eroded black Americans' ability to sort of go under the radar when America is in controversy?
First of all, when I think of Condoleezza Rice, I don't think of her as a black woman. I think of her as a right-wing Republican. And so I think that that same view is similar when people look at her overseas. Look, when you remember Jesse Jackson would go around and rescue people around the world, I mean, we spent a lot of Christmas following him doing that. He went there because he had the credibility of the civil rights movement behind him. Condoleezza Rice is not seen in that same vein, so I don't think people first look at her as a black woman. They look at her as an extension of the Bush administration.
Speaking of the
Farai,
go ahead, Julie.
Excuse me. I mean, you have to distinguish, too, between Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell. It was a very different kind of energy. I mean, she is seen solely as a mouthpiece of this administration, as George said. So I think of her as a black woman. No, think of her as Bush's right hand. You couldn't think of Colin Powell that way. And until he had the famous anthrax statement at the United Nations, he almost got a pass. He got the black pass. She doesn't get the black pass, and she doesn't basically trump anything that anyone else is doing from the African-American community.
I wonder if it's seen that way by other folks who may not know as much. But let me move on to something again about the Bush administration. Historians polled by the History News Network are giving Bush failing grades, not just for, you know, contemporary events, but in history. Buchanan was considered the worst president. The 15th president of the U.S. was considered the worst. But now George W. Bush may take his place in history as the worst president. However, can we really judge a president if we haven't walked in those shoes in the Oval Office? Marcelo.
Yes,
it's very difficult, of course, because the question of the final historical judgment on the Bush administration will have to await maybe a generation, two generations, for us to really be able to place the current performance of the administration in historical context. Having said that, I do think that there is an emerging consensus, not only in the field of history, but in the field of diplomacy, in a number of other fields, that the mistakes, the grave mistakes of this administration will have a very, very special place in our historical recollection of this era when the book is finally written.
Julianne, I heard you jumping in.
That was me.
Oh, yeah. Two people.
Both of
who
you.
I would,
everybody jumping in.
Well, two people who, you know, I can't judge Mr. Bush, and frankly, you don't want to know exactly what I think of him on radio. But let's just say that John Kenneth Galbraith, who served every president from Roosevelt to Kennedy, has placed him as one of the worst. The journalist Helen Thomas, who began reporting in 1943, who joined the White House Press Corps in 1961, has also described him as one of the worst. So people who have been up close and personal with presidents, who have looked at this, you know, in context, and everyone on this, you know, all of us in this roundtable, I think we don't have necessarily the Galbraith or the Thomas historical experience. But when folks like that say he's the worst, I'd have to say he pretty much is. His failure, especially, we talked about the economy before, there has been no economic leadership in a time of economic transformation. There's been a lot of, you know, beating on your chest, but economic leadership when other countries are investing and he's divesting in things like education really indict him, if not as the worst, certainly as among the most ignorant.
And well, even conservative historians apparently are signing on to say, hey, he wasn't that great. George.
Well, you know, I disagree. I think the worst for me was Ronald Reagan. You know, he comes into office with a failed deficit of less than $1 trillion. He triples that when he leaves. This is a person who starts off his campaign in Philadelphia, Mississippi, where three civil rights workers were killed. He gave us William Bradford Reynolds, who went out and tried to undo voluntary affirmative action commitments. Appointed Greenquist, elevated him, appointed Scalia, Clarence Pemberton, let's not forget him, at the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, and then tried to disband that. And I mean, also preside over the worst recession since the Great Depression. He's my candidate.
Yeah, but he's got an airport named after him and a new set of stamps, and
that's another story for Ryan.
How many highways they have? If you Google Ronald Reagan Street, Ronald Reagan Highways, they have named so much stuff after that man, you know, that it's not even funny. But that's just because, you know, some people are looking for a hero, and he was Big Daddy after what people considered as a lax period. George, he's bad, and you reminded me of a couple things. So let's just call it 1-2. Let's make him tired for worse.
Is anyone going to defend George W. Bush? I guess not on this roundtable. Uh-oh, I hear the sound of silence. Well, anyway.
Farrah, you're going to have to call Michael Myers for that one.
All right, we will have him on next time explicitly to do a defense. We've been talking with economist and author Julianne Malveaux, who's at Member Station WFDD in Greensboro, North Carolina. Also with Marcelo Suarez Orozco. He's been in the New York Bureau and he's the co-director of Immigration Studies at New York University. And of course, George Curry, editor-in-chief of the National Newspaper Publishers Association News Service in Laurel, Maryland. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.